This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Meffert Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffert.
Hey, everybody. Great to be with you again. I am going to maybe at some point get a response from this New York Times writer who wrote this absolutely pitiful piece in the New York Times this week. I'm trying to get some answers from her because she wrote a story that is ridiculous, and I'm going to tell you about it. It involves white evangelical women in Texas who are going for Beto O'Rourke, the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate, up against Senator Ted Cruz. Now, if you're not from Texas, surely you know how red Texas is. And as red as Texas is in general, the evangelical vote in Texas is overwhelmingly red. And such has been the case for a long time. So it was curious to me to see the headline on this story. Beto O'Rourke may benefit from an unlikely support group, white evangelical women. Okay, well, first of all, first red flag, she profiles five women. Do you know how big Texas is? This is Dateline Dallas. She profiles five women, describing them as similarly conservative church goers in Dallas. All are longtime Republican voters. She talks about how they're standing around a kitchen island and buzzing with excitement about Beto, but she never tells you where they go to church. She doesn't really tell you a whole lot about them in detail. She says one of them broke ranks on the abortion issue to vote for Hillary in 2016. Oh, okay. They're longtime Republican voters, but so pro-life that they voted, one of them voted for Hillary. Okay. Right there, I'm beginning to get a little suspicious. But then it says in the Senate race, one of the most unexpectedly tight in the nation, any small shift among evangelical voters, long a stable base for Republicans, could be a significant loss for Mr. Cruz, who, like President Trump, has made white evangelicals the bulwark of his support. To Democrats nationwide, who have largely written off white evangelical voters, it also sends a signal, not just for the midterms, but also for the 2020 presidential campaign, that there are female religious voters who are open to some of their party's candidates. Elizabeth Dias, the writer of this story, news flash, five people does not a trend make. And have you not noticed that there are, in fact, a few scattered liberals around Texas? And just because you say that they all voted Republican, how am I supposed to check that out? One of them voted for Hillary. So you can throw her right out right there. She's not a Republican. She's not a conservative anyway. No conservative would vote for Hillary. What I found really interesting, though, is how little information that she gave about these five evangelical women in Dallas who were all buddies. And I thought, where do they go to church? What do they do? I don't understand. She quotes this one woman named Tess Clark, who said this, "I care as much about babies at the border as I do about babies in the womb." She confessed she was mortified at how she used to vote because she had only considered abortion policy. She said, "We've been asleep. Now we've woke up." It describes Clark, who sells candles poured by refugee women in Dallas, beginning to weep as she recalled visiting a migrant woman detained and separated from her daughter at the border when an older white evangelical man recently told her that she couldn't be a Christian and vote for Mr. O'Rourke. Miss Clark was outraged. She said, "I keep going back to who Jesus was when he walked on the earth." Well, he's still the same. This is about proximity to people in pain. And I thought to myself, this is kind of odd. Refugees. Wait a minute. Let me do a little research here. Oh, wait a minute. Hey, guess what I discovered about Tess Clark? She and her husband co-founded a refugee resettlement group. Now, what are the chances of coming down to Texas and doing, you know, just walking down the street as a New York Times reporter, you're just looking for random evangelicals and one of them just happens to be a refugee activist? Kind of a vested interest, don't you think, in probably voting for Beto O'Rourke, Mr. Open Borders O'Rourke? Yeah, probably. Never mentioned. Never mentioned that she and her husband founded this group called Seek the Peace. Another woman who's mentioned in the article is a woman named Kelsey Hensey. And she's one of the five. And she is described as somebody who has gone to Dallas Theological Seminary. And she also talked about how she had adopted a black infant as Donald Trump swept the Republican primaries and had realized how much she needed to learn about race and said it brought the torrent of everything else. When I look at Cruz, I think he sees Republican politics. When I look at Beto, I think he sees vulnerable people who need to be supported. Okay, now here's what I found to be very interesting. When I started looking at that, it turns out she's a Bible teacher at the Village Church. Okay, that's fine. She's a Bible teacher at the Village Church. I don't know how frequently, but I found a document for the Village Church where she teaches. She's taught a couple classes on 1 Samuel. Fine. Then I found, via some friends at the American Family Association on the 990 for Seek the Peace, that the Village Church donated almost $21,000 to Ms. Clark's group. And I thought, I wonder what's going on here. So was it the case that the New York Times reporter just called up the Village Church and said, can you find us some liberal women? You know, I mean, because this is a church, Matt Chandler's church, as we've played some of his stuff before. He's a big ERLC guy with Russell Moore. He's very much into the social justice warrior stuff. He's very much into the white privilege scolding. He's very much into the refugee issue, clearly, because he's given a lot of money to this woman's organization. Now, I'm not trying to be mean to anybody, but what bugs me about it is, first of all, the premise is not true. The premise is not true. The first day I read this, 2 days ago, Ted Cruz was up by 6 points. And now, yesterday, he was up by 9 points. So there's no blue wave that's going to undo Ted Cruz unless something dramatic happens between now and the midterms. But even more than that, in the story, when she gets into hard evidence on statistics and data involving the voting bloc in Texas, she disproves her own premise. She debunks her own premise. This is what the story says. It's far from clear how much influence voters like these Beto moms and their friends will have in the Senate race. Well, none. I mean, that I think you could safely say none, pretty much none. Texas remains a deeply conservative state. 1 in 3 Texans are evangelical, according to the Pew Research Center. 85% of white evangelical voters in Texas supported Mr. Trump in 2016, higher than even the national average, which was a record high for a presidential election. Republican strategists dismissed the notion that their Texas base shows any signs of cracking and gave data showing Cruz leading O'Rourke within the evangelical camp, 87% to 11%. So basically, her entire premise is debunked. Her whole thing was, oh, white evangelical moms in Texas love Beto. Really? You found 5, and you wouldn't even say where their churches were. She quoted 1 Cruz voter, and she completely identified the Cruz voter as belonging to First Baptist Dallas, which is pastored by Dr. Robert Jeffress. Why didn't you tell the churches of those 5? Could it have been they all went to one church? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I know there are ties. 2 of them have ties to the Village Church, Matt Chandler's Social Justice Warrior Church. So I just think it's kind of interesting. And you know what it really shows me is the fact that you can't take the media at face value, especially when they start writing about Christians and they start writing about politics or anything else, pretty much. But you really have to put on your skeptic's hat and you really have to dig into this stuff and say, what's the real agenda here? Did they really come to Texas and try to find out what the trends were among white evangelical women? Or did they have a premise that they began with and then they began to try to look for women to fit the premise? I'm betting B. And the reason I'm betting B is because I've lived that dream. I've worked in newsrooms where editors operated that way, or sometimes reporters operated that way. Hey, I got an idea for a story. Let's talk about the blue wave in Texas and find some white evangelical women who look like they'd be conservative. You know, this is completely contrived and completely unsupported by hard data. And as each day goes by, Cruz's lead grows stronger. So why are you even writing it? Well, they're writing it because it's activism. They hope that Texas at some point will turn blue. They hope that they can undermine the evangelical vote because they know how key evangelicals, especially white evangelicals, were to the election of Donald Trump. And they don't ever want that to happen again. So it's a propaganda piece. And they're not the only ones who write these propaganda pieces. The Washington Post does it all the time. You see all kinds of outlets in the mainstream media that are manipulating data, or not necessarily data, but manipulating people's impressions of evangelicals in ways that they cannot definitively prove. So I think it's very important for everybody to keep your eyes open when the media starts making this claim or that claim or the other claim or trying to create an impression in particular, that we just use our discernment and question whether or not they're really telling the truth. We're going to come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. A lot ahead, so stay with us. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Imagine what it would be like if America were decimated by a civil war and millions of us had to flee for our lives. Imagine living in a crowded tent city with very little to eat, no education for your kids, and the threat of Islamic radicalization and sex trafficking all around you. Well, that's been the situation in Lebanon for several years now. In fact, 2 million of these refugees are living in tent cities in Lebanon, but there, they're finding the hope of Jesus Christ. That's been the situation because of our wonderful ministry partner, Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is there among the refugees right now, offering the gospel of Jesus Christ, food to eat, and a Christian education for the many, many children who are in great need. At Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, little children like John are learning to read, getting nutritious meals, and hearing the good news that Jesus is his Savior. Not only are these children coming to know the Lord, but so are their parents. And when they go back home, they'll be taking the gospel with them to parts of the Middle East that many of us could never reach. Your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 of these refugee children, while a gift of $98 will feed and educate an entire classroom full of children. That's 18 children for 1 entire day. We really need your help right now, so we're asking, call right now, 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Let's help create the next great Christian missionary force. The Lord is working in the hearts of refugee children in Lebanon, but we need your financial help. 866-485-9187. Again, your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 refugee children. Please call now, 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Thank you for being here. We are so excited about our partnership with Heart for Lebanon. We've been telling you a lot about the wonderful work that they are doing and seeing how the Lord is working in the lives of these many, many children who are living in these disease-ridden tent settlements in Lebanon. These are the innocent victims of war. There are still so many over there who don't know Jesus Christ, and it's a tremendous ministry that Heart for Lebanon has. You can be a part of it. For $22, you can help 4 children receive a Christian education, get meals to eat, and also hear the gospel of Jesus Christ for the first time. For a gift of $98, you'll be able to help a whole classroom full at Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers. That's 18 children. We do need your help right now. If you can call 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187, you'll be making a huge difference in a child's life, and not just the child, but often the parents as well. There is a banner to click at Janet Mefford. Too. But right now, we are really excited to have with us Camille Melke, who is the founder and executive director of Heart for Lebanon. Camille, so good to have you with us. How are you?
Thank you, Janet. Great to be with you again. I'm doing well, and very grateful for this opportunity to talk to you and to your listeners.
Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, Camille. I know that a lot has been going on in Lebanon and a lot has been going on with your ministry in the last several months. Can you bring us up to speed on what the Lord is doing right now in Lebanon, where you are?
Yes, we're very grateful for the God-sized opportunities given to us to share the love of Christ with folks who have suffered tremendously. Of course, we don't celebrate their brokenness. We don't celebrate the hardship they're going through, but we definitely celebrate the inroads, the opportunities that we have to be the hand and feet of Jesus to people who have suffered so much hatred, so much anger, so much destruction. And you know, people who come from a Muslim background flee through the mountains into Lebanon, coming from Syria after the 7.5 year of war there. they come with a lot of questions. Muslims are seeking answers. They want to know the truth. And there's no truth but through Jesus Christ.
Amen.
This is our opportunity today, our God-given opportunity to share with them the love of Christ, reach out to them, and lead them to accept him as their personal savior.
What is the situation right now? Well, I know you have three hope centers where you reach out to these children and give them education, a Christian education, and also the food that they need, and also introduce them to Jesus Christ and their mothers oftentimes as well. And fathers sometimes will also come to know the Lord. But how bad is the situation? Just to paint a picture for American listeners who might not know about what is really happening in real time there. What does it look like right now?
Lebanon has 1.6 million Syrian refugees. Roughly one-third of the population of Lebanon today is a refugee from Syria. Lebanon is considered the largest per capita host of refugees worldwide. This means there may be other countries who have more refugees by numbers, but no country like Lebanon has as many refugees per capita. This is adding a lot of difficulties to the socioeconomic situation in Lebanon, but also to the religious mix. Lebanon is one-third Christian, one-third Muslim Sunni, and one-third Shia Muslim. And with this very delicate divide in our population, every problem that happens across the borders in Syria definitely has tremendous effect in our country. As you mentioned, Janet, we have three hope centers. One in the Bekaa Valley, 12 miles away from the borders with Syria, one in southern Lebanon, and one in Beirut. And in each one of those hope centers, we have students, children at risk, refugee kids who have never had the opportunity to be in a classroom setting in the last 7 years.
Wow.
Come to our center, not only get a good education, but also experience the love of Christ through our godly men and women who are serving them.
Yeah, it's an incredible ministry opportunity, and we've been telling listeners a lot about it, and I know people are excited about what you're doing. What is special about what you're doing, Camille? Because it's interesting, we hear a lot about, oh, you should accept more refugees into your country, but as you and I have discussed before, for a lot of these refugees you speak with, they don't want to move to the United States necessarily. They'd like to be able to go back home. What you are doing there in sharing Christ with these children and their families is also broader than just helping them, because you are creating perhaps a new Christian missionary force, because when these new Christians go back home, now you have Christians in places where there might not have been any before.
Very true, Janet. We've never seen a Muslim response to the gospel like we are seeing in the last couple of years. I dare to even call there's a revival among the refugee population. God is giving us a tremendous fruit and results to the opportunities that we have. You know, when we sit there in a refugee tent settlement, listening to the heartbrokenness and to the terrible stories of killing, destruction, forcibly being displaced from their homes and towns, when we sit there, we look for every opportunity to share a word of encouragement, but we are also people of our own struggles and miseries. Lebanon have survived the civil war of 18 years of civil war. So we also have our own stories of brokenness and how God has restored and redeemed what was meant for evil, turned it for the good. And when we share that with the refugees, their eyes are wide open. They're attentive. They're recipient. They're thirsty to hear a message of hope. And we all know there's no hope without Jesus Christ.
Yes.
A lot are coming to faith. A lot are in our Bible study groups. We have today more than 1,300 individuals in every month, every given month, who are participating in one or more of our discipleship programs, our worship gatherings, our Bible study groups. This is unprecedented times. This is the Esther moment of the Middle East. And we cannot fail the refugees. We cannot fail to care for them physically, but also we cannot fail to care for them emotionally and spiritually. Absolutely. And you're very right. Many of them, the vast majority of them, don't want to immigrate, don't want to go anywhere but back home.
Yeah.
Our goal is to send them better citizens, not only for the country of Syria, but also better Christian citizens who would themselves be herald of peace, messengers of Christ's peace in the midst of their communities.
It's just wonderful to hear about it. Again, the number is 866-485-9187 if you can give a gift today. $22 will help four children there in Lebanon through Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, and your gift of $98 will rescue 18 children, an entire classroom full for an entire day. It's 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. Camille Melke is with us, the founder of Heart for Lebanon. Camille, how great is your need right now in terms of getting support from Christians to help continue to do what you're doing?
Janet, the sad part is our government in Lebanon is becoming careless, even more so today than it has ever been towards the refugee population. Most kids have no place to go to, no school, no safe environment to study in, no safe playgrounds to play in. And those children are becoming subject to radicalization. If we at Heart for Lebanon and like-minded faith-based Christian organization don't reach out to those kids, they will be brainwashed, indoctrinated by radical Islamists.
Yeah.
This is today an urgent appeal. Every day we have mothers and fathers who come to our centers. Please, we beg you, take our children. We need you to educate them. We need you to put them in a safe environment. We need you to share with them the smile, the hope that is seen on your faces. They might not be able to articulate what's the source of that hope and that smile, but they know there's something different in us, and that is Jesus Christ. We need to make sure that more kids have the opportunity to learn in a safe environment. More kids have the opportunity to be children again, their innocence to be restored, and that they will never be subjected to further harm and further radicalization.
Right. That's such a key point, because you've said that before, that they are at risk of Islamic radicalization, recruitment, but also trafficking. That's also a problem, isn't it, where the tent settlement city is?
That's very true. There's a lot of children forced to work at a very small age. They're being forced into labor camps. And many, many of them are being also subject to sexual harassment, and they're being even forced to work in child pornography and child prostitution.
Ugh.
We have to protect these children.
Right, we sure do. And all the wonderful stories we've been sharing here on the show about these children who have come to know the Lord. But one of the most exciting things to me, Camille, is hearing the stories of how sometimes their parents also come to know Christ. And that's just an incredible thing that the Lord is doing.
It sure is. You know, we have this big truck that we converted into a mobile theater. We call it Hope on Wheel. We drive it into the tent settlements where the refugees live. That truck is a theater that opens up and children rush to it and want to sing along, play with the staff and hear a story from the Bible. But what we have experiencing also is that parents and older siblings, they gather as well. First of all, joyfully gathering, seeing their own brothers and sisters, their younger brothers and sisters, their children joyful again. But they're learning those songs. They're hearing those Bible stories. And more so, they're learning the true message of hope.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Call now, if you would, 866-485-9187. Heart for Lebanon needs you. Camille Melke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you.
God bless. We'll be right back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Is the Hippocratic Oath dead? One has to wonder, given a radical proposal that was recently published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. There was a piece, Voluntary Euthanasia, Implications for Organ Donation. And in this piece, Dr. Ian Ball and two bioethicists urge that in countries where euthanasia is legal, the dead donor rule should be loosened. In other words, they advocate that organ donors who die by lethal injection should not have to be declared dead before their vital organs are procured. This is just awful. We're going to find out more about it now from bioethicist and author Wesley J. Smith, co-chairman and senior fellow of Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. You can check out his great blog over at National Review Online. Wesley, great to have you with us. How are you?
Thank you, Janet. It's even worse than that. They want the act of killing to be the act of taking the organs.
Yes. So explain to us what they're talking about here, because you do a great job going into this in the piece you wrote about it.
Thank you. What has happened, and in fact, in my first anti-euthanasia piece 25 years ago, 1993, I warned that if we started legalizing assisted suicide and euthanasia, it would lead to organ harvesting joined in as a plumb to society, to give society a stake in people being killed or killing themselves. That has been happening in Belgium and the Netherlands, and at least one case in Canada, all of where lethal injection euthanasia is legal. And so what has happened is that in the most prestigious medical journal in the world, the New England Journal of Medicine, without rebuttal, without a word or a breath of criticism, the people who you identified in the introduction wrote a piece saying, well, where euthanasia is legal, we shouldn't force people to be lethally injected and die and then have their organs donated. We should have the organ transplant surgeons do the actual killing via removal of organs while the patient is alive. And this is a tremendously disturbing concept on several levels, made doubly awful by the place in which it was published, the New England Journal of Medicine. This isn't some kind of crackpot off in a corner with a tin foil on his head.
No.
This is the most prestigious establishment medical journal in the world.
Well, now, is the reasoning here, the reason they want to loosen the dead donor rule, is that, as I understand it, because the organs would be fresher if you did it that way?
Yes. So you see the utilitarian crescendo that begins. It starts with, oh, people are suffering. If they want to die, let them die. Then it goes to, well, since people are going to die anyway, we might as well get their organs since it can do good for the living. Then it's, well, why should we lethally inject people when we can just kill them directly via the organ donation process? And the idea is to have a better chance of having well-preserved organs. But the dead donor rule is one of the things that makes organ transplant medicine palatable to the people. And the dead donor rule has two aspects to it. Number one is that before a vital organ can be donated, the donor has to actually be dead.
Right.
The second is that the cause of death can never be the extraction of organs. You do away with that, and you do away with the fundamental ethical premise of transplant medicine. I think it would shatter the already thin trust in that sector. Worse, perhaps, you're going to turn some of our greatest healers, that is transplant organ transplant surgeons, if this came to pass, and we have to emphasize it is not being done now, it is being proposed, you would turn some of our greatest healers into killers.
Yeah.
And you would turn one of our greatest healing and beneficent sectors of medicine into one that takes human life. That would destroy so much of the fundamental bases of medical ethics It's just stunning, and yet not a word of criticism, not a word of rebuttal. And this idea that we should allow people to be euthanized and harvested is really abhorrent.
Oh, I can't even wrap my head around it. So are we looking at a scenario, for example, where you have somebody who wants to be euthanized and you roll his body into the operating room and then you have the guy who needs his heart next to him and then you take one guy's organs out and then is that what they're talking about?
Well, right now what happens in Belgium and the Netherlands and at least one case in Canada is that if somebody wants to be euthanized, and by the way, in the Netherlands and Belgium, this includes the mentally ill.
Wow.
So you're not talking about people who have cancer or Lou Gehrig's disease or something like that. You have mentally ill people being brought into surgical, into hospitals. They are infused with poison and die. They are immediately moved into a surgical suite, and their organs are harvested. And then the organ transplant goes the way it would normally go if somebody had died and had a procurement. This is really awful, because what you have done is you've told mentally ill people and others that their deaths have greater value than their lives. These
right.
are people who have a terrible time sometimes getting through the night. The anguish of mentally ill people can be excruciating, and this could be the tipping point to them to say, well, kill me, because if I die, somebody else can have my liver who needs it more than I do. Secondly, it gives society a utilitarian stake in euthanasia, because society can say, oh, maybe my Uncle Charlie can live if XYZ wants to kill himself, let him, and then Uncle Charlie can have his liver. This is treating people, despairing people, suffering people as organ farms. The proper response is always suicide prevention.
Of course.
But now we are in a situation where we're not only refusing to give certain people suicide prevention if they're sick or mentally ill or whatever it might be, depending on the jurisdiction, but we're also saying that we want to give them an incentive because they're being good for society. This is really, really frightening.
Oh, it is.
And then you look even further up in Canada, they're now advocating child euthanasia to go along with their euthanasia law. And I wrote an article on National Review Online. This is in a major bioethics journal, that doctors should be able to kill mature children who want to die if they're sick and qualify for euthanasia without even any parental notification.
Mature children, that's a bit of an oxymoron.
Yeah. So imagine you're a parent, and let's say your kid is 15 or 16, and the doctors decide he's mature enough to make a decision for himself. You go to the hospital to visit your sick kid, and the child had said, don't tell my parents, but I want to be euthanized, and the doctors did it. And the first you hear about it is you go to the hospital and you find your child is dead. Can you imagine what that would be like?
No.
That's been advocated in a major bioethics journal. I write about these issues because these are not happening yet, but this is how policy changes. These journals propose these articles. You can call them trial balloons, whatever you want. But unless there's pushback, these things can actually be implemented and come to pass.
Absolutely. So then would the surgeon under this scenario be the killer rather than the physician who was responsible for the lethal? It would be the surgeon who would kill by doing the surgery then.
Yeah, the organ removal would be the cause of death.
Oh, man. What surgeon? I mean, I'm sure they could probably find some surgeons, but it would seem that most surgeons would not really want to be part of that.
One would hope.
Yeah.
But, these days, who knows?
True. That's
and then
right.
You've got an issue of medical conscience. Should a surgeon, you have major bioethicists like Ezekiel Emanuel, again, writing in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I'm emphasizing that because that is as establishment medicine as it gets. That is as respected in the world as it gets. Ezekiel Emanuel, who was a major architect of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, wrote that every doctor who is requested by a patient to perform a legal service that the medical intelligentsia accepts must either do that service find a doctor who will if they have a religious or moral objection, or get out of medicine. That was what Ezekiel Emanuel wrote.
Right.
He specifically referenced abortion, that every doctor should have to participate in abortion. But if organ harvesting conjoined with euthanasia was ever accepted by the medical profession, it isn't now. But if it ever was, and the first step to getting it accepted is publishing in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Wesley J. Smith is our guest. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Janet. It's hard to imagine what it would be like to be forced from your home and made to live in a dirty tent city in a foreign country. And yet that's exactly what has happened to millions of people who have fled their own lands to find refuge in the country of Lebanon. Now consider this. Most of these refugees are children. The tragedy is that Lebanon is overburdened and unable to keep pace with the refugee crisis. So there are 2 million refugees in Lebanon today. The children don't go to school. They don't have enough to eat. They're targeted by Islamic radicals for recruitment. These are children who need hope, practical help, and the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's why we here at Janet Meffer Today are so honored to partner with the great ministry Heart for Lebanon. Through their Hope Centers, Heart for Lebanon gives these children food, a Christian education, and exposure to the gospel for the very first time. When you call 866-485-9187 with a gift of $22, you'll help rescue 4 of these children and give them an entire day of care and the gospel in Heart for Lebanon's Hope Center. For a gift of $98, you can help an entire classroom full of children. Just call 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Here's the incredible part. Not only are these little ones coming to know the Lord, but so are their parents. What the Lord is doing in Lebanon is incredible. And once these families are able to move back home, just think about the impact they'll make on their home countries for Jesus Christ. This is an incredible window of opportunity that we have to make an eternal difference in the lives of these little ones and their families. So please call now, 866-485-9187. Again, with a gift of $22, you'll help rescue 4 children. And for $98, you can rescue an entire classroom. Call now, 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. There's also a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Please pray and give whatever you can while the Lord works in the lives of these children. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. We're back on Janet Meffer Today. It is a really, really disturbing situation to see what even mainstream and top-of-the-line medical journals are beginning to print on this subject of euthanasia. And we're talking with Wesley J. Smith, co-chairman and senior fellow of Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, about a piece he wrote highlighting what is going on, a piece that was printed in the New England Journal of Medicine, no less, about putting together euthanasia and organ donation by loosening restrictions on the donor rule. And it just, sorry about that, Wesley, we had to run to a break there, but
sure.
I mean, you're talking about the surgeon then being the killer. Is there some rationale where they don't want the physician? Is it about the physician who gives the lethal injection? They're trying to take it away from him, or is it more that they want the organs to be fresher? I mean, we kind of touched on that before, but what is really driving this, in other words?
Right. In the article, the idea is, why should we have to have the wait between death and procurement, which can lead to some organ damage depending on the organ? Some organs, for example, kidneys last a lot longer than other organs, such as, we'll say, the heart. So the idea here is purely utilitarian, purely for production values or efficiency, right?
Right.
So that to make sure that we don't lose the viability of any organ, why go through the dying first process since they're going to be harvested anyway and they want to be killed anyway? Let's just get right to the organ harvesting and taking a beating heart, taking a liver that's still functioning out of a body would leave the organs fresher and more likely not to deteriorate before they can be transplanted. You know, if we start buying into this, you know, the ends justifies the means concept in healthcare, we're in big trouble.
Huge.
Because it really denies the equality and the equal moral value of people who would be harvested and killed. It already does. I mean, in euthanasia already, you have assisted suicide in Oregon and so forth, where so far there has not been any conjoining of organ harvesting. There's nothing to say there couldn't be. But so far there isn't. I'm not sure whether the swallowing of the poison would prevent the organs from being transplanted or not. But you already have a whole category of people who commit suicide, who are denied suicide prevention, where people with other categories of suicidal desires would receive suicide prevention. You're treating people with serious conditions unequally when you do that. You're saying your life, of course you want to die. Your life isn't as valuable. We are not going to give you suicide prevention like we would others. More than that, we're going to say the state, by a law, is going to say, yes, this is proper. You should have suicide if that's what you want. Whereas with, say, let's say somebody whose children had died or whose business had collapsed and they were suicidal, the state wouldn't say that, at least not yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the Netherlands, I would point out that the Supreme Court of the Netherlands approved suicide for a woman, euthanasia for a woman who wanted to die precisely because her two children had been killed or died, one of cancer, one of suicide. So, and that led to mental illness being allowed to be the subject of euthanasia in the Netherlands, as it is in Belgium. And pretty soon, it isn't yet in Canada, but I predict because of their Supreme Court ruling a couple of years ago, where they specifically referenced psychological pain as grounds for euthanasia, that it will be.
Unbelievable. The New England Journal of Medicine, as you point out in your piece, has been such a respectable publication and was so involved in standing up against this sort of thing, this utilitarianism in medicine, as you mentioned in your piece.
Yes.
How does the mighty fall this far? Are we now in Nazi regime times again? I mean, I thought we were supposed to be saying never again, never again.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. And if people want to read the article, it's in the Weekly Standard.
Yes.
It's called A Gruesome Plan. And if they can't find it in the Weekly Standard or it's behind a paywall, if they go to the Discovery Institute of my articles that are indexed there, they can read it. But what happened was in 1949, a fellow named Leo Alexander, a very great doctor, who was part of the Nuremberg trial process in terms of the medical trials there. You know, doctors were hanged at Nuremberg for killing disabled babies, which, by the way, they now do in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And Leo Alexander, there were other things too, you know, bad experimentation and so forth, horrible, gruesome things. And Leo Alexander was the chief medical examiner, the chief medical expert in these trials. And in 1949, in the New England Journal of Medicine, which was then much more reputable than it is today, in my opinion, he wrote a warning. And he said, listen, there's a real problem here. He said, this is Leo Alexander from 1949. Whatever proportions these crimes finally assumed, it became evident to all who investigated them that they had started from small beginnings. The beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift in emphasis in the basic attitude of physicians. It started with the acceptance of the attitude basic in the euthanasia movement that there is such a thing as a life not worthy to be lived.
Yeah.
That's really important. It doesn't, you know, and I don't have time to get into it, but the euthanasia in Germany wasn't because they were Nazis. It's because they believed in eugenics.
Yes, that's right.
Which is a highly utilitarian viewpoint.
Yes.
We are back to that same kind of attitude, only now it's in the United States. And I submit, as I wrote in this article, that if Leo Alexander came forward with that wonderful, and it's an historic piece. I mean, it's really a piece that has echoed down the decades since then. If Leo Alexander went to today's New England Journal of Medicine, they wouldn't publish it.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Because it would be not utilitarian. It would stand up for the Hippocratic Oath and the sanctity of human life. The New England Journal of Medicine, I now call it the New Euthanasia Journal of Medicine, is rejecting the sanctity of human life in healthcare.
Yeah.
If we don't have the sanctity of human life in healthcare, we're in big trouble.
Oh, yeah.
We need to have doctors who believe in the value of our lives no matter our condition, not doctors who will say, oh, well, that's not a life worth living. I don't want to be in a situation where I can't find a doctor who wouldn't, under some circumstances, be willing to kill me.
Right, exactly. Of course not. I mean, that's, you know, this is all the more reason to keep the United States from going the way of the Netherlands and Belgium and Canada,
absolutely,
as you've mentioned. So, but where does the Death with Dignity movement stand right now? They have their successes and their setbacks, but I mean, it seems like getting ahead of this train and stopping it is just a continual duty that we have.
Right, and let's reject the death with dignity issue altogether, because my dad died naturally of cancer. Are they saying my dad didn't die dignified?
Right.
I mean, that's just a horrible thing to say, that dignity in death is being poisoned.
Exactly,
that's
right.
What we're talking about.
Yes.
Well, right now in this country, you have 7 states with the District of Columbia that have legalized assisted suicide. That is, doctors prescribing poison for patients who have who they say have 6 months or less to live. By the way, Janet, there have been cases of some people who receive lethal prescription to live 2 and 3 years. So, you know, people don't die by the numbers. And if you're ideologically predisposed to prescribe lethally, you may not, you know, hold to that 6 month line. Some of these states, Colorado, for example, Washington State, for example, require doctors to lie on the death certificates as to the cause of death, so that stating rather than the cause of death is assisted suicide or, you know, death with dignity, whatever they want to call it, they have to lie and say the cause of death was the underlying medical condition when it wasn't.
That's
the
wrong.
Cause of death.
That's wrong.
So that's corrupting vital statistics.
Yeah.
That's also making it so there can't be any transparency, because you can't look back and do any kind of comprehensive studies using death certificates and other kinds of statistics that way to check how this is all working. So euthanasia and assisted suicide are profoundly corrupting. You now have situations where families are holding, or people are holding, suicide parties, and family members are expected to attend. And these are being touted positively in the media. The New York Times, for example, had at least a 3,000-word front page story. I mean, that's huge for a newspaper, about a suicide euthanasia party in Victoria, Canada, last year. I think it was last year. You've seen stories like this in the LA Times. And this could leave some of your listeners in a real, what I call a social martyrdom, or personal martyrdom. That is, they get called by Sister Sue, and Sister Sue says, you know, grandma's got cancer. She's expected to live for another 6 months, but she's dying next Tuesday, and she wants you to be there.
Ugh.
She wants you to say goodbye. So what do? If you don't go, you know, then Sister Sue says, well, you're imposing your religion on grandma. How dare you abandon grandma? She paid for your college, this kind of thing. How dare you judge grandma?
Ugh.
If you do go, you're complicit in the suicide.
Wow.
And you're validating grandma's worst fears, that she's a burden and things of that sort. It's a terrible circumstance.
Absolutely. We can't do that. Well, read Wesley J. Smith's great piece, A Gruesome Plan, at theweeklystandard.com. Wesley, thanks as always. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Janet.
All right. Take care. And we thank you for listening today. We'll see you next time.